Hello, I'm Ian Danter, and you're very welcome to episode 11 of The Commentator's Curse. This is the podcast where we kind of lift the lid on the weird world that us commentators inhabit, and it is a weird world. I've been doing radio commentary on football and other sports for over 20 years now, and everybody I meet in a press box or on a gantry has a very different story to tell about their journey to get where they are, and that's kind of what this show is all about. And there's an archive of episodes that you can listen to from episodes 1 to 10 where you found this particular episode, and there's plenty more to come. So whatever your podcast provider is, you'll find everything else you need there. And thank you for all your kind comments, incidentally, about the podcast. I had one comment come through on a message about an episode where, well, I shan't embarrass the person who was being interviewed, but they said, I didn't know much about this person, but it was fascinating and it made me want to learn more about this person. So again, that's what it's kind of all about. So let's get on with this episode and introduce my two guests for episode 11. My first guest is a colleague of mine at TalkSport, who's actually quite unique in terms of this podcast. And I think he's the first guest we've had who combines print journalism with work as a commentator, because he does an awful lot of work on the South Coast, writing stories for Southampton, Portsmouth and Bournemouth for tabloid newspapers, as well as his commentary work on TalkSport and our international service that goes around the world. It's Alex Crook who's with us on the Commentator's Curse. Hello, Alex.
Good morning. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too, sir. And along with Alex, a guy who has been a favourite commentator of mine for a good while. He straddled the worlds of not only radio and television, but BBC and ITV during an illustrious career. He's got a vocabulary that is... it's quite unique, and it's wonderful, and it's very individualistic. It makes him, as far as I'm concerned. Peter Drury is with us on the Commentator's Curse. Good morning, Peter.
Morning, Dance. This is lovely. Thank you.
Well, it's nice to have you both with us. And there's a kind of... I know you two don't know each other before this conversation, but there's a kind of synergy between you two when I think back to last weekend, because whilst Liverpool were dismantling Manchester United at Old Trafford, Peter, you were there, yeah, commentating on the game, whilst Alex was quietly seething as a co-presenter in the TalkSport studio as a Manchester United fan. It was described as meltdown on the Twitter feed. I think that's probably a little excessive, but nevertheless, Alex, you had to sit there and take it whilst your team had been taken apart. You wouldn't want to be commentating on that particularly, would you?
Perhaps I rather would have wanted to be commentating, because I find it quite easy when commentating to separate being a fan and calling the action. But obviously when you're in the presenter's chair, and Darren Bent from very early in our relationship made it known to everybody that I was a Manchester United fan, you almost feel a bit more freedom to let go. I don't know if I was quietly seething. I didn't do much quietly over the course of Sunday evening, to be honest. I can only describe it as watching a car crash unfold slowly in front of your eyes. I mean, it was a horrendous afternoon for any Manchester United fan. And I'm sure when Peter looks back on it, it will actually go down as probably one of the most seismic games in Premier League history. And I don't think that's being too extreme when you look at the rivalry and you look at the fall from grace of Manchester United and where Liverpool are now compared to where they were in the 90s when United were at their pomp.
But in your position, Peter, you're commentating on the game. You're in the midst of it all, in the thick of it. And I can't imagine... You're meticulously prepared, as we all are for games, but I can't imagine you'd have had many stats to hand about the last hat-trick that an opposing player scored at Old Trafford, or the last time Manchester United were beaten 5-0. Or did you have that to hand in your notes, ready to go?
Dance, I'd love to tell you I had all of that ready, but obviously I didn't. And that's why the guys back at base come into play. And yeah, when silly things were starting to happen and records were on the cusp of occurring, people were digging away and coming up with that sort of information. The first opposition hat-trick at Old Trafford, or for Liverpool since 36, wasn't it? 1936, I think. They're actually, to be perfectly honest, there's stuff I'd still like to know about teams who've won successive games away from home in the Premier League 5-0 or more, which Liverpool did. This weekend was so weird. I mean, I'd like to know, like Watford, who were the last team to concede five at home and then the following weekend score five away. There, all sorts of ridiculous things occurred this weekend, but nothing more ridiculous, as you rightly say, than Manchester United Liverpool. And I think seismic's fair, Alex. I really do. I mean, that scoreline just cannot happen. It's utterly inconceivable. And it did.
What you've alluded to there, Peter, is that the teamwork that you can sometimes call upon. You may not need it all the time, but in instances like this, as a commentator, you've got people who can either feed stuff into your ear, or you can get something on your tablet or on a phone that you can call upon. I mean, this is modern technology that can be used to our benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. Dance, as you rightly say, I think we all take pride in being properly prepared for every game we go to, for covering all bases. Someone said to me years and years ago, it's your job as a commentator to arrive at that game knowing more about it than anybody else does. And we all like to believe that we do. But for all that, the truth is that things can happen which go beyond what you could possibly anticipate. And you've got to be reasonable and humble enough to acknowledge that. It happens particularly at World Cups, actually, where the stats, if you went into them to the nth degree, can take you into places that there aren't enough hours in a day to go to. So, you know, when was the last African to score a hat-trick against an Asian opponent? You know, all of that sort of stuff. But, of course, Manchester United against Liverpool has a life of its own as well. So we're talking about stats in the Premier League era. We're talking about stats ever. We're talking about stats within the Manchester United Liverpool scenario, and if you're not very careful, stats can become immensely boring. You know, they're just meaningless numbers that sort of blur into a morass of nothingness. So picking out the good ones is a part of the art, and recognizing when something has occurred which is beyond what is pre-anticipated or anticipatable, if that word exists, which it probably doesn't.
Yeah, just a small example of that. Obviously, we were on air 5 till 8 on Sunday, so we picked up the second half of the game, the end of the first half, and the reaction from United fans. And I have to say, usually it's mixed. There's a lot of United fans until the weekend that were still very much in the Ollie in camp. I think that did change even during the course of the game on Sunday. But we had a couple of pre-recorded interviews planned, one with Rodri of Manchester City, ironically, and one with Robert Sanchez, the Brighton goalkeeper. We played out the Rodri interview. It was only about 5 minutes long. And the producer was planning to also play out Robert Sanchez in the final half an hour of the programme. And I said to him, I'm not telling you how to produce here, but this is a seismic result in the Premier League. I think if we play out a 15-minute chat with Robert Sanchez when United fans are ringing the phone off the hook, we're going to look stupid. I think just get Darren Bent to say, we were going to hear from Robert Sanchez, but due to events at Old Trafford, we'll hear from him next week. So I think that sums up that you can have all the preparation that you want, but sometimes something happens on the pitch that just throws that all into turmoil. And I maintain we made the right call.
By the way, Alex, I can empathise with you for what you were going through on Sunday afternoon, because some years ago when I was presenting Talk Sports Sunday afternoons, there was a Blues Villa derby at Villa Park. And we got cuffed 5-1, I think, in the end, I think was the final score at Villa Park. And my evil producer, David Earle, I'm going to name check him because he deserves this name check. After every Villa goal, Nigel Pearson, our colleague, was at the game doing the updates. And every time they came back to me after a Villa goal, the producer played the Victorian Death March before he opened my mic fader. So he leaves it 20 seconds. I'm not in control, of course, of whether I switch my microphone on or off. That's down to the producer. I've had to wait an interminable length of time till this stupid Victorian Death March has played out for a couple of bars before I can say anything. And, of course, it gets progressively worse as goals 2, 3, 4, and 5 go in. So, yeah, I'm with you on that, Alex. I'm completely in your corner at having to maintain a veneer of professionalism whilst all around you wants to swear like a docker.
Indeed.
Let's go back to the start. Actually, I'll start with you, Alex, because obviously you're a colleague of mine at Talk Sport. But one thing I'm finding with this podcast, and we'll discover this with Peter as well, that hotbeds of broadcasting talent aren't just centred around London. Yorkshire and the South Coast have become particularly significant to me as a place where people learn their craft. And of course, the South Coast has been your bedrock.
Yeah, more just based on the fact I was born here than anything else, and I get a nosebleed if I tend to go any further than the Watford gap. I did stray from the South Coast for my first job in print journalism. I went to a paper called the Slough Observer, and that was a great learning ground for me because Slough was quite a newsworthy patch. I was doing news as well as sports reporting. I was covering Slough Town, who were quite a big non-league club back then, the Rebels. They're not so much now. But I enjoyed the news aspect as well because I think having an idea how to write a news story does help when it comes to sports stories as well because the two often transcend each other nowadays. Then I went to the Bournemouth Echo for a bit. That was a very different patch to Slough. A much more sunnier outlook in more ways than one. Covered the Cherries, covered the first ever game at the new Vitality Stadium, actually. And then ended up working for a local news agency in Portsmouth, MY News Agency, long established, supplying copy from the South Coast to national papers. I still do that now. I now run the agency and have various stringers that I use. But I always had an interest in getting into football commentary. I heard Adam Blackmore last week, actually, on this podcast, and he was saying that he used to play Sabutio and tape games on the radio. I used to play Sabutio and actually commentate to myself in my dad's study. That was how I first learned how to commentate, I guess, although you're still learning all the time. And yeah, from the newspaper side, I started to knock on radio stations' doors, began doing local commercial radio in Portsmouth along with Sam Matterface. And I followed him around a bit, as it turns out. I did a bit for IMG when they were the rights holders for TalkSport, for Premier League international commentary as TalkSport are now. Covered Chelsea for a while as understudy to Gary Taphouse, now a very prominent television commentator at Smooth Radio. And then slowly worked my way into TalkSport, first of all with the international arm, as you mentioned, and gradually began to get more of a presence on the main station and commentate for them. So all the while, still, as you said at the top, Dan, maintaining my newspaper interest. And then I love the balance. You know, I enjoy writing. I probably find writing easier than commentary, to be honest. I'm far more tired after doing a commentary than I am doing a newspaper report. It's obviously a lot more intensive and you have to be fully focused for the entire 90 minutes or 2 hour program. Whereas with the newspapers, you can sort of drift off a little bit and even catch up on anything that you've missed.
Was journalism always the plan when you were at school?
It was, actually. Yeah, I always enjoyed the English language. So I was quite fortunate in that from probably about the age of 7 or 8 playing Sabutio, I wanted to be a football commentator. I knew I wasn't good enough to be a footballer, and I think we're probably all frustrated footballers. That's how we end up in this job. But I came to that realisation very early and then made it my mission. And I got a lucky break in that I was doing a BTEC in media at college because I hated exams. And there was an old newspaper journalist who oversaw the newspaper element of that course and actually recommended me to skip the university degree and go straight on to the postgraduate NCTJ course, the 20-week course, which taught you court reporting, which taught you about political reporting, shorthand as well, which is a skill that I still use. So basically, I saved myself 4 years and was able to go into my first job in Slough as a 19-year-old. I don't regret that. I think I'd have enjoyed the university lifestyle. I probably would have enjoyed it too much, but I'm not sure it would have helped me career-wise.
Peter, was university a destination you undertook?
Yeah, I went to the Dreaming Spires of Hull and did my degree in politics, dance, and I graduated in 1988 from the School of Boothroyd Park, where I used to spend my student grant watching Hull City in those days, Brian Horton's Black and Amber Army. And I was a trainee accountant for a month and realised that that was not my calling. I was hopeless. And also, I had a little dream. And, I realised that getting up and doing the much, frankly, much more important work than commentating is wasn't for me. I wanted to play for a living. And my lucky break was after much rejection, and I think we've all suffered much rejection. I'm afraid that comes with the territory. I got work with Haters Sports Agency in London, which back then was still run by the legendary Reg Hayter, who gave me my job in a very old-fashioned way based on my handshake. That's how it was back then. I know that sounds almost Victorian. Wasn't quite Victorian. Anyhow, I did a couple of years there. And then I got my broadcasting break, getting a job with the BBC, as you hinted, in Leeds. BBC Radio Leeds. And I was very lucky because it was a great training ground. And I followed Yorkshire cricket. I even learnt a bit about rugby league, which for a soft southerner was a crazy departure. I've forgotten it all now. I was lucky enough to be there when Leeds won the title, the last pre-Premier League year. I was on top of Leeds Town Hall, standing 2 yards away from Eric Cantona when he uttered those famous words, "I don't know why, but I love you." And of course, as Alex knows, 3 months later, he was wearing red. But it was a fantastic time to be up there.
So what sparked the dream that you refer to?
Well, I'm out of the Sabutio school as well. I certainly commentated on my own games at Sabutio, and I commentated on everything that moved. I mean, my era was a time actually when before video had killed the radio star. You know, so there was barely any live football on the telly. And when it did come around, it was an extraordinary big, big day. But I, in that classic way, used to go up to my bedroom on a Saturday afternoon and lock the door and let it all unfold. I wasn't part of a family that went to football, actually. That was a big missing part of my education. It wasn't until I went away to university that I went and watched professional football matches. So I guess I had a profound fascination with the broadcast of football matches, as well as the football matches themselves. I could look out of my bedroom window, and we lived opposite a park, and my dad used to get up in the morning and walk through the park to pick up his morning newspaper and walk back. And without him knowing, I used to commentate on his walk back as if it was the sort of last 200 yards of the Olympic 800 meters final. And as he reached the front door, you know, that was the finishing line. I used to commentate on anything, you know, washing the car, doing the ironing, doing the washing up. Everything was a sort of event that needed articulating in this slightly hyped way.
Everybody's got Sabutio except for me as a child. I had Striker. Do you remember Striker?
Of course, yeah. Boss the head.
Boss the head down. And the heads used to last about 2 months on average, and then you'd have to go to Ray Hitchcock Sports Shop and see if they had any spares. Yeah, Sabutio was something I missed out on. My cousin had Sabutio, so used to go around to his house just around the corner and make the excuse just because he had it. Because he had the floodlights as well, and he had the scoreboard. Yeah, big
fans, yeah.
The floodlights just got in the way, Dan.
Yeah,
they just got in the way. You put them up to start with. And sorry, Alex, you're looking very sceptical about this. You obviously loved your floodlights. But for me, they would just got it, especially for a corner. You had to move the pylon.
That's very true. Very true. We also had that test match game, the cricket game where
I remember that. The
little metal ball went down the ramp. But yes, we used to set it up in our lounge, me and my brothers, and we used to have an extended dining room table. And we used to pull the dining room table apart just a little bit and set that line where the ball would move.
Yeah, very good.
Cracking and just make batting that bit more difficult. It's horrible to each other as brothers. Moving on, when it comes to your progression, Alex, as a South Coast reporter, can you remember your first game or when the transition came to get an opportunity to be a commentator as opposed to just a print journalist?
Yeah, and listening to a lot of your podcasts, I know you love the sort of unconventional route into it. And I would say that my route maybe is as unconventional as they come. It was always a desire of mine to be a football commentator. And I got to know Sam Matterface, who I mentioned earlier, quite well when he was the main commentator for the Key Radio, a really successful breeding ground, actually, down in Portsmouth. And his arrival alongside Mickey Quinn coincided with the collapse of ITV Digital and therefore Pompey cashing in and under Harry Redknapp winning promotion to the Premier League. And it was during their first season as a Premier League club, Sam came round to my flat where I was living at the time, and we had a few drinks, as we still tend to do. And I said, I could be a commentator. I could do what you do. He obviously knew me as a newspaper journalist at the time. And he said, go on then, prove it. So we set up the PlayStation. And he played a game of FIFA against my nephew, Sam Turndown, which again, commentating on FIFA was another regular habit of mine. It used to drive my relatives mad. And I think we drank pretty much a bottle of whiskey between us by this stage. So my first commentary demo was live with the head of sport at Key Radio, inebriated. And he said, actually, you're not bad. Would you like to do half and half commentary of Portsmouth against Gillingham in the FA Cup next weekend? And it went from there.
Wow. So what year was that? 2005.
I think it was the year that Southampton got relegated. Yeah, 2005.
Okay. And Peter, can you remember your first assignment? This will be for BBC Radio Leeds.
Yeah, I probably did a bit of radio reporting while I was at Haters for various independent stations around the country. But yeah, my first commentary would have been Bradford City against Notts County, I think, in the spring of 1990.
Right.
I think, yeah. I mean, I can't claim to have had a bottle of whiskey before it. I'd love to have done. I can claim, I think, to have been pretty average, frankly. One of the things you learn pretty quickly, as you guys will both appreciate, is that probably the absolute fundamental of commentating is identifying players, you know, and knowing who you're talking about. And that might seem really simple and very, very obvious. But I think a lot of people, particularly, and it's not their fault, it wasn't my fault. I was in local radio where I'd spent the whole week preparing the bulletins, doing other stuff, blah, blah, blah. And back in those days, I don't know if it's still true of the guys who are coming through at that level now, but essentially you turned up at the ground, picked up the programme and looked at the back of it and, oh, he plays for them, does he? You know, and that's not to say you weren't prepared in the sense that you believed you had to be prepared, but you didn't quite understand that the nuts and bolts of this thing are to articulate what's going on the field. And okay, so Bradford City were the team that I, as a Radio Leeds commentator, had to know a bit about and presumably did. But there was another team called Notts County. And, you know, I don't think I had the tools at the time. And I'm sure everybody who manages to chisel a career out of this ridiculous occupation must look back with gratitude at the days that they were forgiven for being useless. And I look back at those early days and I think somebody said, okay, let him have another one. Let him have another one. And, you know, you need that good fortune, that tolerance.
Well, the first game I did, I talk about this a lot, it was 9 years further on from yourself. It was early 99 when I was thrust into the world of, well, it was reporting, but it was also full off-air commentary that I was doing for Capital Gold, Warsaw Chesterfield. Now, I had 2 days to prepare because Tom Ross had sprung this on me with barely any notice. And this is kind, internet was kind of in its infancy, so a website like Soccer Base did exist so I could get information on Chesterfield's players. I knew a bit about Warsaw's squad, being, you know, from around the region. But I crammed for a day on Chesterfield and binged everything I could find out about, you know, Kevin Davis and Morris and some of the other players. Come the game, the players all run out. Swifty the Swift, of course, comes out first. The Warsaw mascot diving into the goal mouth at one end and his head come off, which wasn't good for the young children in the Banksy's end. And then Warsaw come out, beautiful red shirts, white numbers on the back. Chesterfield run out with a dark blue, navy blue strip with a very light pinstripe and cherry numbers on the back.
Yeah.
Indecipherable. Yeah. Indecipherable. And I'm for the first 20 minutes, although I was only on air once for an update, I was doing commentary and I couldn't place a soul in that Chesterfield side. It didn't do any good for the nerves. And it still happens now. Going to PR on Tuesday.
Yes, it does. And the panic rises, doesn't it?
Yes.
The panic rises. You think, listen, I think I am ready for this. I do know who the players are. But then suddenly, particularly on the floodlights, you get a bad set of shirts, a bad coloured number on the back of them. And doesn't matter who you are, how long you've been doing it, you think, shucks, you know, I'm not quite sure here. And when a goal goes in, am I going to have the confidence to shout the name? You know, that's the ultimate sort of litmus test, isn't it? Will I shout the name when the ball goes in the net? And there are still occasions when you think, I'm not certain I will until I've seen a close-up.
Absolutely. Alex, I mean, you must still suffer with that. I had it on Tuesday night at QPR against Sunderland. Again, it was only updates, but, you know, two ridiculous sets of shirts with... Why can't they just put panels on the back so that you can read the numbers in a white square?
Well, certainly a few years ago in the Premier League, they did bring that in as a regulation, but the standards seem to have slipped again. Reading are a bit of a nemesis for me when it comes to that, because you're quite high up, as you know, in the press area at the Madejski Stadium, which is in the top of the main stand. Yeah. They, like QPR, have the blue and white and the red numbers. It's a real nightmare. And, it certainly makes the tension levels rise.
If I may, I mean, we're talking about it from within our little village of commentators, which is the point of this conversation. I get that. But let's be frank, the point of numbers are so that everybody can identify the players, that the people who've paid their money can look on the back of the programme, or whatever you do these days if you don't buy a programme, and see who's playing. That's the point. And there really isn't. We might as well not have numbers if you can't see them.
What made it worse with Reading, if you're going to mention them specifically, Alex, they made the numbers kind of funky as well. They didn't use a kind of a standard font. So Gareth McCleary's number 12 shirt looked more like a 17. Yeah. So of course you look at, who's the number 17? And there is no number 17. Well, who's that? That's 10 seconds of commentary gone by, and by which time he's long since got rid of the ball and somebody else has got it.
I'm guessing you guys use the same tricks that I do in terms of frantically scribbling down what colour boots each player is wearing in the warm-up. That's always... I say it's always a good way, but quite often now they all wear lime green boots, so sometimes that doesn't help either.
Sometimes it's a sweatband or an armband they've got, or maybe it's just their hairstyle. Or, you know, you can't miss Lyle Taylor at the moment for Nottingham Forest with his pink hair that he does for cancer awareness. So, let's go for that.
Those 30 minutes or so of warm-up for me are the most important preparatory minutes of the whole process. Those points of identification between two similar-looking centre-halves, just finding that point. I always tell a story, Dance, about Cristiano Ronaldo, believe it or not, who scored a goal for Manchester United in a Champions League game in the Olympic Stadium, Rome. And I was commentating on that game. And mercifully, before that game, I had done what Alex had just said. I'd had a look around the Manchester United players, who, of course, were all perfectly well known, and spotted a couple of pairs of boots. And Ronaldo was wearing red boots that night. And he scored with a header, flying through the crowd in the penalty area. And I was able to shout, "Ronaldo!" And fine, the goal went fine. And I think back to that. And had I not, what I saw were his red boots flying through the air. Didn't see him at all. And of course, the viewers, if I had failed to identify Ronaldo from a commentary position at that huge ground, which is a million miles away from actually, would have thought, who is this idiot who can't recognise the most famous player in the whole of world football? And it's always driven home to me the importance of taking that time, if you possibly can, in those 20, 25 minutes when they're running around in front of you, to work out ways of seeing who's who.
As long as you can make out the players from the ancillary staff in that warm-up, because it was Bobby Gould who once pointed out to me about 10 years ago. I was at Villa Park with him for a game, and he suddenly digs me in the ribs at about 20 past two. He goes, "Look out there! Look how many! Look at them!" Villa must have been about 10 coaches out there. He was raging at the fact that there were all these people. How much is he getting paid? How much is he getting paid? And he's probably right. There's a lot of people that do get an awful lot of money for not doing an awful lot in that sort of 20-minute warm-up session for the players. You know, there's balls, bibs and cones, like dear old Terry McDermott used to be so often, and then there's the level down from that, and people still get paid for it. mentors. Alex, you've mentioned Sam Matterface as being very, very important to your development. What specifically was he able to do for you, you know, in those early days when you were trying to develop a style, because everybody's got their own style?
Yeah, I think more the preparation, actually. And I remember before that game against Gillingham in the FA Cup, going around to his house, no whiskey this time from memory. And he basically showed me his commentary notes and how he used to prepare for a game. And that stuck with me ever since, really. I mean, Sam as you know, is a big techno geek. So the way that he correlates information changes almost on a weekly basis. I think he's currently using an iPad. I, like Kevin Hatchard, our European football expert, Bundesliga commentator, use stickers. So I have a template of each team that I commentate and just update it as I go on and then print it out. It enables you to line the teams up in formation. I'm sounding really geeky here. And then as a sub comes on, you put the sticker over the player they replace, etc. But just the level of prep that Sam did then, and I know still does now, probably does even more prep as his career has progressed, that stuck with me. Because as much as I thought I knew how to commentate from Sabutio and FIFA, I didn't know how to prepare for a commentary. And as Peter says there, although the commentary was heavily Portsmouth-based, it would have been foolhardy not to prepare for the Gillingham players as well. Again, like you, Dan, that would have involved raiding Soccer Base and various websites, whereas now we're in a very fortunate position that certainly for a Premier League commentary, we have access to the Premier League stat packs that are prepared by Opta. I mean, there could be 25,000.
Some of you do. Not all of us have access to that, you know. All of us are privileged.
But I was reading the other day, there could be 25,000 words on every Premier League game on that stat pack. So again, to emphasise what Peter was saying a few minutes ago, you need to work out what stats are important and what stats are just there for its own sake. But certainly, yeah, Sam has mentored me in terms of preparation and to continue to maintain high standards. We do a twice weekly podcast together, as you know, Dan. And if my standards ever slip on that podcast, then he will make it known. And, you know, I don't mind that. Constructive criticism, I think we all have to take that on the chin.
How about you, Peter? Was there anybody in those early days at BBC Radio Leeds that you particularly gravitated towards?
Well, I had a very sympathetic boss. And I was, I guess, I don't know how familiar these names will be to you, but in the Yorkshire area then, there were two kind of giants of broadcasting, one commercial and one BBC. John Helm. Helmy, everybody knew from that era, and by the way, still going strong, and one of the loveliest guys in broadcasting, who I would later, in a sense, as he got towards the back end of his career, replace at ITV, in that sort of the ITV pecking order, which was both jarring and joyful for me, because he was such a kind, kind man. And continues to be, actually, and a really, really good broadcaster. If you listen back to some of what Helmy did in the 70s and 80s, you find, you know, if you look these things up online, the odd World Cup 82 goal or whatever, wonderful, wonderful stuff. And at the BBC, where I was working, Harry Gratian, who, again, I think has only just, I can't believe it, but has only just retired from presenting Look North in the Yorkshire region at, you know, 6:30 every midweek evening. And so these were two sort of opponents, but they were around. And if you got approval from them, it mattered a lot. And then I guess going forward, I've been very lucky to have the ear at various times of Motti and Barry Davis and, you know, then Martin Tyler and so on. People have been very, very kind. They really have. And how could I miss out Brian Moore? I mean, I got my break at ITV because Brian Moore was retiring, and I still have a letter in my attic somewhere, which certainly in the early days, if I had a bad day or, you know, I thought, cool, I'm not doing this, or I was taking some flack, I could find that letter from Brian Moore telling me, you can do this, by the way, you're really good. I think, well, if he says I can do it, that'll do for me.
Wow.
And he was again, a really kind man.
I wish I'd met Brian Moore. Everybody who came into contact with him has nothing but the kindest words. But they also mentioned how incredibly hardworking he was, how dedicated he was to...
He was so worried, Dance. He was every game... He fretted over. I think we all do to an extent. It's part of the commentator's kind of makeup. You worry. And if you stop worrying, you've probably time to give it up, because The point is to worry. He was meticulous and he was fraught and all of those things, but he was kind and he had a lot of time for me. Very fortunately, I learned plenty from him.
I think that's important as well, particularly in the modern era where social media can be very toxic at times, and we're all open to criticism just because of the profiles that that gives us. But anybody who thinks that if we do make a mistake or we do say a line out of place, it's because we haven't put the effort into the preparation, is wrong. I don't know any commentator or any broadcast journalist who doesn't prepare in the same meticulous manner that Peter has been talking about. And I think maybe football fans need to realise that. I guess we're in quite an envious position. They would like to be doing our job, but not everybody can do it. And anybody who doesn't put the hard work in to make sure they are their absolute best, I think will quickly be found out, particularly now. And I would include ex-players in that as well. Even when I first started, there were ex-players who would just turn up for a game and not know who the opposition were, not do their preparation. I don't think that happens now. I think the ex-pro, certainly that we use at TalkSport, all put in just as much prep time as commentators do and don't take their position for granted, as none of us should.
If not more so. I would throw somebody like David Connolly into the mix there, who does, I think I do more than enough prep. And then David turns up with his mighty A4 desk diary filled with scribbles. I mean, he's a Luddite like me. He doesn't use iPads or anything. It's all actually, to be different, he just uses one colour pen, whereas I use four. But there's not a spare square inch of space on the three or four pages that he uses for every game. And that's it. You're right, Alex. That's invaluable to the likes of you and me, because you know, and Perry's the same who I work with, and I'm sure like Jim Beglin, who you work with regularly, Peter, you can throw anything at them mid-commentary, and you know that they're prepared to give you an answer because they're on the money.
Do you know, the sort of person you're talking about, and you're right about Jim, and the guys that you two work with, very often, and this is a terrible generalisation, so I wouldn't want anybody to read anything personal about any individual into it, but very often, it's the guys who are not necessarily ex-superstar footballers who do that work, because for them to carve out a career, they know they've got to be good broadcasters because their name in itself won't be sufficient. Mm. So David Connolly, who I've heard with you guys often on the radio, very, very good broadcaster, who obviously goes out of his way to know what he's saying. If he was Pelé, you'd have him on TalkSport anyway. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because he's Pelé. But he's not. And so in order for him to chisel out a lasting career, he's got to make sure he's good. And that goes for quite a lot. And in terms of the preparation they do, I think it's important for people to understand that it's a different preparation to what we do.
Yes.
You know, we are answering the question, what, where, when. They're answering the question, how and why, because they're former pros who understand how the flipping game works when you're out there doing it. And so certainly Jim Beglin, he thinks about not whether Salah scored 15 goals in the last 12 games. He thinks about Salah's movement and what he's doing that's making a mug of the fullback. And he jots down little things like that so that when I ask him the question, he's not just stating the blindingly obvious. He's got something separate and meaningful to say.
I would agree with that. And I think it's important to separate the two. Our job is to call the action. Maybe sometimes give a bit of our own opinion, but really it's the ex-pundit's job to do that and tell you why certain things are happening, and also break it down into layman's terms, to language that people who haven't played the game, like us and like our listeners, can relate to. I think it's a really underrated skill, that.
I had a relatively unique situation last Saturday at Crystal Palace. Usually I've just got the one summariser with me, but because Crystal Palace Newcastle was suddenly a very big game for the reasons we all know about, management decided I should have two pundits with me. So I had Perry Groves, as I'm normally used to, who's wonderful. And I worked with Darren Ambrose for the first time, who you work with every Sunday as a presenter, Alex, on TalkSport. But it was my first game I'd done with him as a pundit. And I approached it, I don't mind saying to you, with a little bit of trepidation, because you're trying to devote as much time as you can to the two gentlemen sitting either side of you. You don't want one to dominate or over the other, or you don't, you know, want to feel like you're ignoring somebody. But I have to say, one thing that crops up with this is ego and the lack of it that people like Darren and Perry have. And their lack of ego contributes to the quality of the commentary, in that they don't want to get in the way of each other or me or detract from what's going on. So actually, as it turned out, although I was flapping like a kingfisher beforehand, it was actually a quite pleasurable experience. I don't know how many double-handers you've had to do, Peter, in your life, where you've got...
Yeah, one or two, and I take your point, Dan, so I think that's really important, but that word ego, or lack of it, is really critical in what we all do, and certainly in what they do. You're right, they've been former players, so I guess there would be an inclination towards what have I done, what's he done, you know, how do we compare? I think most of them don't really think that way. And I think we're fortunate enough to meet lots of famous ex-footballers and footballers. And the really great guys don't need to tell you what they've done because you know. If they're telling you, that's probably because they think you need to know and you don't already. Do you know what I mean?
So, Trevor Francis, he shakes my hand and goes, hello, I'm Trevor Francis. I'm going, bloody hell, mate, I know who you are.
Correct. Correct. And I have to say, I've worked with Alan Shearer a couple of times as well. I had exactly the same thing. I went up, shook his hand slightly trepidatiously, saying, hi, I'm Peter Allen. He said, yeah, I'm Alan. And I thought, yeah, I know that. And he was similarly humble. But I think just, sorry, Alex, I know you're trying to come in and I will shut up in a second, but I was just going to say that lack of ego for all of us is important because I say this till I'm blue in the face and sick of hearing myself saying it. Nobody turns on the radio or the television for the commentator, except maybe your mum. You know, nobody turns on for the commentator. They turn on for the match. And the day you think that it's because of you that they've switched that switch is the day you need a slap. And, you know, it is absolutely, you are attracting nobody. Crystal Palace against Newcastle was attracting your listenership with respect, Dan, and I know you know that.
Yeah.
So there's no need for us to have an ego because we are not the point.
And I guess it's the old refereeing analogy. The sign of a good referee is somebody that you don't notice. And as much as Peter, you've been noticed for delivering some incredible lines at big moments, really the first job of a commentator is not to court attention for the wrong reasons. Because as you say, the public's attention should be drawn onto what's happening on the pitch as opposed to what you're saying in the press box.
Absolutely. And when we come to great lines, Peter, you do have more than your fair share of moments where I know you don't do socials, but you have gone viral. I know that Hawksby and Jacobs, our colleagues, got you on the day after Kostas Manolas' magnificent last gasp header in the Stadio Olimpico when Roma beat Barcelona. And my word, if ever I don't wish to blow smoke because you're sat here on this call, but to capture a moment like that in the way that you did. I don't know how proud you are of that moment or whether pride even comes into it or whether it's just simply gratitude for having been there to witness it in person. I don't know.
Well, that's principally it, Dance, to be honest. It was that night was an alignment of planets, actually. I was very fortunate. I turned up at that game extremely relaxed because everybody was watching Liverpool Man City that night. I was at the Olympic Stadium, Rome. Messi was playing. What's not to like? Kind of, I thought this is lowish profile, not a problem. Enjoy. I hadn't even really given any thought. Perhaps this is dereliction of duty. I should have done to the possibility of Barcelona being knocked out that night. Until Roma got to within one goal, and then you know what it's like—a sort of light goes on. You think, shucks, do you know what? If they score again, this is going to be a thing. At around about the same point, the Liverpool-Man City game was done and everybody turned over. Of course, I wasn't aware of that particularly. So suddenly there was an audience that I wasn't aware of. And that's a real sweet spot because it means that you're relaxed in the sense you think nobody's really watching. But you've still got the story and you can. And so I suppose as a result of all of that, I was pretty uninhibited and I kind of let rip. And what came out, came out. And honestly, because I don't do social media, I absolutely promise you this. As I walked out of the ground that night, it didn't occur to me that it had made a ripple. It really didn't until one or two people started texting saying, do you know your thing's gone mad? And I said, well, who was watching? And they, well, everybody was. Oh, really? And yeah, the next, funnily enough, Dan, I'll tell you a little sort of behind the scenes thing that in 20 years or more of traveling, doing Champions League games for ITV and BT and whatever, mm-hmm. that is the only trip the only trip I've ever taken my wife on. And so we had a spare day in Rome the next day. And we were doing Rome. You know, we did the open top bus. We did the, you know, Colosseum. We went around doing all the things you have to do as tourists in Rome. And my phone rang all day and I didn't speak to her. So there you are. It was a really weird, weird day, because if it teaches us any lesson, it is just be ready, because when you least expect it, that's when it's going to happen.
What have the Romans ever done for people? Well, quite a lot, as it would appear. But that's very true. Controlling the narrative of a game as it's unfolding in front of you is one of the chief skills that a commentator has to work out, Alex, that the idea that there's a story unfolding in front of your eyes that may not necessarily be obvious to the listener. There are obvious, I mean, obviously when Liverpool go 3 or 4 nil up at Old Trafford, that story takes care of itself. But being in control of knowing where the narrative is going is vital, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, at times you can get lucky, as Peter did to a certain extent that night. Probably my most favourite piece of commentary was Patrick Schick's goal for the Czech Republic against Scotland. It was my first on-site commentary at a major championship. And
my word.
Exactly. And he just comes up with one of the goals of the tournament, one of the best goals in the history of the European Championship. But I was pleased with the way I called it, because I saw it from fruition. It was Jack Hendry, actually, who took a shot from 45 yards at the other end, and it left Scotland hopelessly exposed. And I said, I'm not sure that was the cleverest idea. And all of a sudden, the ball drops for Patrick Schick on the halfway line. And I knew it was in all the way. I could see that Marshall was floundering. So it was just one of those occasions where I was fully sharp, fully focused, and able to call it. But a few days earlier, I'd actually covered the Denmark-Iceland game. The horrible events surrounding Christian Eriksen. I remember saying to my wife as I went out the door, that was a game that we did off tube, therefore not on site, but from a studio in London. And on the brink of my first major tournament on site, I said to Mrs. Crook, well, this will be a nice gentle introduction for what's to come in Scotland. How wrong was I? Because all of a sudden you spot the situation where a player has collapsed and his wife is being brought onto the pitch, seemingly a very dire situation. And I know that the host broadcaster were criticised for the fact that they continued to broadcast pictures as that unfolded. But what that meant was that we continued to have the pictures in the basement at Talk Sport and therefore had to keep talking for 45 minutes.
But that's when your skill as a journalist comes in, doesn't it, Alex? In terms of your knowledge, you talked about court reporting and political reporting and just knowing where you can and can't go in terms of how you describe these events.
Yeah, absolutely. Because what you can't do in that situation is take a punt. Not that you would ever do that when, you know, you're literally in possibly a life or death moment. But what I was doing was trying to get information on CPR techniques, on the fact that a lot of grounds now have defibrillators inside stadiums. I was getting information from people that I knew who work in the medical industry and, you know, asking, what do you think the situation is here? What point should I be stressing? It was a real learning curve. But you're right, probably, and maybe I didn't realise it at the time, but those journalistic skills probably did kick in. But what I guess I'm trying to highlight here is that for all the preparation and planning you can do, for what was a big game for Iceland anyway, for me, Iceland were the narrative before the game, because it was their first major tournament. The narrative very quickly took a very dark direction. It's not a game that I will ever forget, but did it improve me as a broadcaster and a commentator? I think it probably did.
I think back to Russia 2018 when we had been in Sochi to do Uruguay-Portugal, and myself, Adrian Durham, Matt Holland, Declan, our producer, and Will Dowie, son of Ian, our Russian translator. We had to get a train from Sochi to Rostov, but it was one of those crawlers, a crawling train that takes 11 hours to weave through the Russian countryside to get to Rostov. It was the only mode of transport we could actually obtain to get from city to city, because we were doing Belgium, Japan the next day. It was a horrible train journey, non-air conditioned carriage. It was deeply uncomfortable for all of us. So we get to Rostov. The hotel we're staying in is not the best. and we're all really, honestly, the morale was pretty low. And we turned up at the Rostov Arena the next day for Belgium, Japan. And foolishly in my mind, I'm thinking, well, this is Belgium's, you know, that Japan have never got to the, you know, quarterfinals of a World Cup before. Why should this change? Golden generation. How wrong was I? Because 7 minutes into the second half, Japan go two up. And suddenly you realise, stop being presumptuous about what you think you're going to see. Don't forget about what mood you're in. Forget about what you've been through. There's a game unfolding in front of you that is completely unique. And any predictions you may have made in your head, just get rid of them because it means nothing. As it turned out, of course, Belgium came back and won 3-2. But for 70 minutes, you know, Belgium were flapping. They're all over the place.
What was I just saying about how mistakes can be made, by the way? I've just realised it was Denmark-Finland, of course, not Denmark against Iceland before people start tweeting in about that.
Well, all I'll do is I'll record the word Finland and just every time you've said Iceland in this, that'll help, wouldn't it?
But it would.
It would help. Social media, we did touch on that, Peter. You've never done it, and presumably there's a reason why not.
I'm a dinosaur. That's the principal reason, Dance. To be honest, I think I'm lucky, and Alex was open enough to say it. Social media can be a friend, and of course it can be an enemy. I was lucky to have the first part of my career pre-social media. I absolutely understand why people use it. I absolutely see why it can very often be a force for good. But I am a relatively private chap. When I finish a game, I want to put the microphone down and go home to my wife and family. I don't want to be updating this, that and the other. I don't really understand the words to, I don't know the language of social media really. And I'm very comfortable with that. I'm wary of this conversation only because I don't want to seem like I, as an individual, are telling everybody else they're wrong. I know I'm much more exception than rule. It's a personal choice. I'll only say this about commentators and social media. That is, sometimes I can go to a game on a Sunday, bump into one of the other lads who's been working like me on a Saturday, and they'll say to me, "God, I got hammered last night on social media." And I say, "Why are you on it then? Well, you're miserable today. Why? You know, you're a very, very good commentator. And you're putting yourself through. Why? You know, all I would say to people is, do you know what? It's not compulsory. It is not compulsory. And people talk about, listen, there are big issues around social media. I know that, around racism and bullying and homophobia and really nasty stuff that absolutely matters. And I'm not belittling that at all. But I would say to people out there that around all that and beyond all that, you have permission not to be on it.
Yeah, it is treated as an occupational hazard, I think, by most of us within the industry. Would that chime with you, Alex? Occupational hazard?
Yeah, it's a fine balance because I think the organisations that we work for, clearly a lot of their business model now is built around social media and clipping up things that particularly I would say on a Sunday night, Dance, and when you've been a guest on shows. And sometimes that does invite somewhat of a pile on. But I think as long as you're true to yourself, and despite what some people might think, I've never said anything for effect. Whatever I say is what I believe. And hopefully I've done the relevant research to back it up. I'm not a clickbait merchant. So I'm comfortable with that. But there was a time, and I made some comments about Norwich City. You may well have planned to bring those up anyway. And the reaction
I wasn't going to bring those up, no.
But the reaction to that was off the scale. And again, like Peter, I was trying to have a family day out. It was on a Sunday night. I didn't plan to criticise Norwich or their business model, but Darren Bent, as a former Ipswich player, asked me a question and I answered it. I appreciate now that when I said they haven't spent any money, clearly they have spent some money this summer. The point I was making was that when they were in the Premier League the previous time, they earned £100 million for going up, spent £1 million, went back down, got £40 million parachute payment and came back up again. Maybe that's a problem with parachute payments as much as it is with Norwich City, but it was clipped up on social media. It was viewed 500,000 times. Now, if you're talking about Liverpool against Manchester United, you probably expect 500,000 views on social media. When you're talking about a club of Norwich's size and stature, with the greatest respect to them, you don't. But the fallout was incredible. I was trying to have a family day out and my phone was pinging every 5 minutes. And that was difficult mentally. I've got to say, that was a tough day. And I got support from the bosses at TalkSport that I appreciate. But it has made me think twice about some of the words I use, because I did accuse them of cheating the system and lacking sporting integrity. And I understand why those words are emotive. And while I think a lot of the points I was making were valid, maybe I didn't need to use such strong language. And that was a learning curve for me. Having said that, I'll accept criticism, but the abuse was quite personal. And I think that is unacceptable.
Could have been worse. You could have claimed you could grow concrete. So, you know, it's...
I saw that.
It's all relative. It's all relative. Peter, one thing I'm fascinated about with people like yourself is when you are asked to go into the world of... Well, Alex mentioned FIFA earlier. Pro Evolution Soccer called upon your services to voice their computer game. Now, actually, back in the day, when I'm going back, you know, 13, 14 years... I was a Pro Evo guy as a player rather than a FIFA guy, even though
me too.
West Midlands Village was the team rather than Aston Villa. Yeah. I couldn't use proper player names. But the process for that would appear to me, to my limited knowledge, to be mind-numbingly boring. Would I be correct in that assumption?
Not on, Dance. Please don't anyone get the impression that there's anything remotely adjacent to glamour involved in doing that job. That is a torturous process of shouting names over many hours in a little booth. So there's not much more I can tell you than that.
How long did the sessions take, typically?
I think, without going into too much detail that I probably shouldn't give away, I think... The annual top-up, as it were, because obviously there is a library that enables year on year. I think the annual top-up is 64 hours.
Wow.
So that's, which takes place, I mean, this year, I did it from where I'm talking to you now.
Yeah.
Because of COVID, which was actually quite nice. I didn't have to get a train into London and all of that stuff. But also was a bit weird with my family sort of around behind me, hearing me shout, "Shira!" listen, anybody, you know, you don't have to be in the broadcast industry to understand how it works. I mean, I don't know how the clever people make it actually work in the real game. That's way beyond my pay grade, but you can guess how it works. I'll tell you a word that, we're all people who think we know words. A word I've learned doing Pro Evolution Soccer is concatenation. Do you know what that means?
Not a clue.
No, nor did I. Nor did I till it meant. But basically, it's making two halves of a sentence dovetail so that they work each into the other. So you're saying, for instance, the name, you know, Danta, 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 Danta. And yeah. Then you're saying the sentence so that it picks up from the correct Danta, so that Danta concatenates with plays the ball wide or passes it forward.
Yes.
All of that. So it's all about, I don't think this is a particular trade secret, anybody could work it out for themselves, but it's all about concatenation. So that if possible, and listen, we don't always, if possible, we avoid those things you sometimes hear on the station where you say, the train now on platform 7, you know, all of that kind of thing. You try, the art, if you can achieve it, is to make every single sentence natural. And sometimes you achieve it, and let's be frank, sometimes you don't.
I've got Tom Ross in my head now going, hey, you wouldn't use concatenation in a commentary. he once tore Jim Proudfoot off a strip for using perspicacity in a commentary, which I got torn off a strip by Tom once because I did a... Walsall Wolves game at the Bescot, and I said that Kevin Muscat tried an audacious lob from the halfway line. Tom gets me in on the Monday for my regular sort of listening back session, as he liked to do, and he played me that bit, and he stopped the tape and said, what was that about? I said, what? Why did you use the word audacious? Audacious lob? Would you say that down the pub? And I said, No, I don't suppose I would, Tom. Says, right, next time, say cheeky chip. And that was it. That was the end of the conversation.
Do you know what I'd have said, Dan? I'd have said, would you say cheeky chip down the pub? You probably wouldn't say that either, would you?
As far as he's concerned, you would. By comparison with audacious lob. So that's true. But you're such a wordsmith, Peter. Even you must wonder, well, have I gone too far?
No, listen, Dan, I totally get this. And words have been my friend and my enemy. There's no question that I would be subject to that sort of criticism, and I completely understand that. And my answer to it is around the word authenticity, actually, if we're allowed to use that one, because in the end, you are who you are, and I think if you're true to yourself and you do, I don't, you know, I hope not so pretentious to set out to have some sort of style and to make it, you know, we're only commentating on flipping football, for goodness sake. You know, it's not that important. Yeah. And I happen to like words, and I use words. And honestly, when I'm talking to people, I use words in the same way. And so that's me. And there might be people who say, well, honestly, how can you use that word of a football match? You know, that's not the language of football. And I say, well, fair enough, but it's my language of football, and take it or leave it. And I totally understand what Tom Ross is saying. And I've had this conversation, as you can imagine, a million times down the years. You know, come on, what's that got to do with football? And I really, really do understand that. And I take it as an absolutely fair criticism.
No, but don't change, Peter. Don't change. Clearly you haven't, but don't.
Yeah. But I think it's not a bad thing to know that conversation's going on in the background for me, Dance. It's a good thing. It's a check. It's a check. And as Alex said earlier, I think we all need checks on who we are and what we do and the way we do it. But I would say Tom Ross makes a perfectly valid point. But do you know what? If you look at the language of commentary as an average, even the way we articulate a football match isn't actually the way we speak to each other.
No,
it just isn't. No. So I would argue, why pretend it is?
Being pretentious, you're not pretending anything. That's the whole, you know, reason of that word, why people throw that as a pejorative at you. Oh, it's pretentious. No, you're not pretending anything.
No.
Are you?
No, I'm really not. I do promise that. I'm not, as I say, I'm not impervious to criticism. We all take that, and I take it as much as the next person. But it is not, one thing it's not, is pretentious, because that's, I'm afraid, for better or worse, who I am.
I don't think there's anything wrong with different styles. We have a big stable of commentators now at TalkSport, but I think we all bring our own different skill sets and our own different ways of how we commentate a football match. And I guess by definition, certain listeners will favour some commentators above others, but maybe that goes back to the point that Peter was making earlier. Ultimately, Manchester United fans aren't tuning in to get Ian Dancer's commentary on the way things are going for their team any more than they are mine. They are tuning in for the game. And maybe if they raise an eyebrow and say, oh, Dan's commentary is a bit different to Alex Crooks or Clive Tildley's, maybe that isn't a bad thing. If we all sounded the same, it could make for a pretty dull industry.
Well, I did ask Sam for notes. I think it's important to do this now and again, to have somebody take a listen to what you're doing, and, you know, one of your peers, and they can then refer back to you and say, okay, look, it was great, but I would pick up on these little specific areas where you could make an improvement. I think that's something I feel is important to do, not constantly, but just to make sure that you're not using the same phrases too often, and that you're not relying on certain things as a crutch to get you through a game that become repetitive. I think that's important, Peter.
Yeah, no, I agree, Dan. And it's a challenge. And especially if you do a lot of football matches, which we do these days, you know, there's only so many ways a centre-half heads the ball away, you know. And we you know, you could have a list of verbs. And I do not so much challenge myself as get bored by myself and therefore feel required to try and find a new word. But if you listen to yourself back, you will find that in any given patch of your career or any given patch of the season, you'll have stock phrases that you go back to instinctively, and they can become repetitive. And I agree, it's worth having someone listen to your work, or, and this is not vanity, really properly listening back to your own work and thinking, do you know what? I've got stuck in a phrase here. I'm in a trough. I'm saying the same thing over and over again. Yeah. And just to spend a few moments considering how else you might say it.
Very early on, I tried to cut out the words and from live broadcasting, whether as a commentator or a presenter. I felt when I heard people say and a lot, it felt, well, do they know what they're talking about? How sure are they about what they're saying and how they're delivering it? That's one area I've always tried to pull myself up on more than anything else. And you're right, Peter, I do listen back periodically to what I do. And if I say or too much, I'm admonishing myself from that moment. You plonker, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You shouldn't have said that there. That's pointless. I presume you do the same, Alex, in terms of your own self-critique or someone to critique.
Yeah. Yeah, it drives the wife mad, to be honest, because she says she hears enough of my voice at the best of times. Doesn't need to listen to it anymore. But I think I speak for us all as well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we're all our own harshest critics. And as we've already said, I do a lot of different elements of the media. I'm an author as well. I've penned a few books, and even now I pick up the books that I have written and read various chapters and think, oh, maybe I could have done that a bit better. And the same with a newspaper report, you know, what you file at 10:30 on a Tuesday night if you're covering a midweek game, and then I'm always up early the next morning to see how it looks in the paper. And again, I'm maybe not quite happy with that introduction. And it's the same with radio as well, and broadcast and commentary. I think I always feel like I can do better, but I guess in some ways that's just my own way of making sure that I never rest and keep on striving to improve.
Do you miss the radio commentaries, Peter?
I mean, obviously, very much, Dan. No, I do. As you guys would appreciate, it's a completely different discipline, actually. You know, but they were happy days. You know, happy days. And I think within, obviously, I came through the BBC, your opposition, but I think what those two principal national radio stations have in common is that both of you have a really lovely esprit de corps. You know, there's very evidently a team spirit with you guys at TalkSport. You know, there's which no television channel I've ever worked with can replicate. And forgive me for saying, I think the same thing exists at Five Live. You know, those guys are a team. They enjoy working with each other. What each other does matters. And there is that intimacy in radio that television can't quite replicate, because television's so big and brash and kind of out there and feels as though it owns the event. Whereas radio does what radio always originally did. It eavesdrops on the event and it tells the story of the event. It doesn't pretend it is the event. And I love that, because that's how it should be in my mind. And I love listening to football on the radio, and one day I wouldn't mind another little crack at it. But
you're spot on, Peter. There's a real team ethic that TalkSport has. I think I get that impression from when you see, Ian Dennis or John Murray or Alistair Bruce Ball at Five Live. That's clearly evident. But Alex will know, because we converse a lot on Messenger. We see ourselves as team players, and we have each other's backs. I'm looking at Alex now, making sure that he agrees with this.
No, I absolutely do it. It's important as well. Again, in times of success, it's nice to get a pat on the back from your peers. It doesn't happen that often in our industry. I think it's quite a brutal industry in that you're quickly told if you've done something wrong. You're not always told when you've done something well. But also in those times of adversity, and again, going back to that Norwich City incident, I had a lot of messages from yourself, Dan, and from people like Adrian Durham, who's been a tremendous mentor and a great friend as well. And I think that is important. And I think that is part of the success for TalkSport, and part of the reason that certainly in the last, decade or so, we've really made quite an impact when it comes to live commentary rights and competing with Five Live. I think we're taken a lot more seriously now by the opposition than maybe we were in the past.
This goes back to the episode with Jim Proudfoot, where he talked about doing unofficial Euro 2000 commentaries from a hotel room in Amsterdam, with Alvin Martin and having to say we are not the BBC every 10 minutes as part of the unofficial commentary. We've come a long way, baby, since then. We've talked for over an hour. I guess we need to wrap this up at some point. I do find gantries fascinating, Peter, because I don't work on one very often. Birmingham City had a gantry that radio broadcasters worked on for a time with the ladder that was pulled up at 2:30 not to come down again until 5:05. but you experience gantries, and you'll have experienced the days in the 90s where gantries probably aren't quite as plush as they might seem to be now.
Yeah, well, correct. Danson, in a way, it's a shame that these days when new grounds are built, they're made for television and the media in general, you know, and some of the great old grounds, of course, weren't quite that. Still at Everton, you know, if you go up to the gantry at Goodison, you have to climb up the back of the stand and up a ladder and over the roof, as you used to. I don't know if that's still the case at Blackburn. I remember, you know, a terrible ladder to climb. I think the sort of best or worst I've done, Swansea City at the Vetch Field.
Never went there.
You used to have to climb up a ladder, a vertical ladder, out of the terrace which housed the visiting supporters. And so I remember climbing up a ladder, and of course the fans are there shaking the ladder, you know, and all that sort of thing. And you get up there, and Luton. I mean, Gerald Luton, who are doing so well at the moment, you know, Luton could be back in the Premier League. And that is funny in television terms, only because the last time I did, it may be better now, the last time I went there, the gantry was basically a couple of planks on a scaffold, you know, up a insecure ladder. I think health and safety's probably kicked in a bit since but there've been some terrifying places to broadcast from, really. Southend, I remember doing a cup tie at Southend. Not from that little press box that we're all familiar with, where you're behind glass and, you know, you're practically sitting on each other's knee, but on the other side of the ground at Roots Hall, where, again, climbing up a precipitous ladder, high ladder with no protection. Doing a cup tie there against Chelsea in the fog. Yeah, wonderful, wonderful.
Cool, blimey. Yeah. That's character building, that, isn't it, Alex? Yeah, to do that.
Yeah, they're a lot stricter now, the Premier League, aren't they? Again, I remember when Portsmouth were promoted to Premier League, and I don't know if Peter, I'm sure he has been to the gantry at Fratton Park, but that was the same. It was the south stand. It was on the roof. And again, the ladder was sort of over the other side of the hoardings, and it got whipped away. It always used to fascinate me that, as a kid, the TV commentators would disappear to the gantry and the ladder would be taken away. And I thought, well, how are they going to get down from there without the help of a parachute? But also, when Pompey were in the Premier League, they didn't really have a press room worthy of the name. So the post-match interviews with both managers used to be conducted outside the gents' toilets in the bowels of the south stand. I remember vividly Arsene Wenger sort of leaning against this dilapidating wall with a smell of urine emanating from the toilets. And I don't think that would happen now because the Premier League are a lot stricter about what facilities newly promoted clubs need. But I guess that was character building even for Arsene Wenger.
Yeah, that lovely aroma in which to conduct a post-match interview. Absolutely. There's a toilet at Crystal Palace directly behind where we commentate.
Yes, there is.
Which is used by all at half-time. But there's an electric hand dryer as part of it. And quite often, if somebody goes to use the facilities as a newspaper journalist during the course of the first half, whilst you're commentating, you can hear the flipping hand dryer going off behind you whilst you're trying to call the action. Somebody's, you know, obviously they're washing their hands, doing as we all should in these COVID secure times. But I could do without hearing a hand dryer whilst Callum Wilson's trying to execute an overhead kick.
But that's real, you see, Dance. You see, your old man Tom Ross, he would say, that's how it is down the pub, and that is the experience of the fan. They are pushing back and forth into the toilet, and you know, if radio had smell, you'd want it to smell of burgers, wouldn't you?
Yeah, onions, absolutely, and freshly mown grass and all that. Yeah, you would love that to come across, wouldn't you? In all the broadcasts that we do. Listen, gentlemen, we've talked for well over an hour, and we could keep going for ages. But what have you got this weekend coming up, Alex, I'll start with you. Because we mentioned the international service, that for those that don't know, means that it's a radio commentary for people around the world outside the UK. That's one hell of a spread you've got.
Absolutely. And I'm doing Norwich against Leeds on Sunday. So that will be popular with the Canaries fans around the globe, I'm sure. Maybe this will be one example where fans turn off because of the commentator as opposed to turn on. And on Saturday, I've got our app-only commentary from the Championship. Really good game, actually, involving Fulham and West Brom, two of the top three. And, again, that's the way that technology has changed now, because we've got the Autumn Rugby Internationals on TalkSport 2, where that commentary would usually go. So anybody who wants to tune into that game can do so via the app, which is, again, I guess, an illustration of the different ways in which people can listen now.
Yeah, it's a great innovation that we've got with the app. Makes things a lot easier, particularly when people are driving. Looking at the listening figures and the radar figures that have come out this morning, there's an increased use of using apps whilst people are driving in car, for those that don't have a DAB system in their car as yet, although that's changing and increasing week by week. How about you, Peter? What does your weekend entail?
Yeah, I've got actually a quiet weekend. So I've got Saturday off. I'm going to go and watch my team play with my family, which I love to do. So that's going to be nice. I'm going to have the proper fan experience. We won't go into the venue, just in case.
Yes.
But, a couple of pints before, watch the game and come home. And then Sunday, I'm at Villa. Sorry to swear, Dance.
That's all right. No,
I'm at Villa. I'm at Villa against West Ham.
You can bleep it out. It's fine. Oh, Villa West Ham. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I've got the joys of Liverpool Brighton this
week. That'd be good.
With that extraordinary bird's eye view that you now get from the new stand. I've managed somehow to blag my car into the broadcast compound. I don't know quite how that's happened, because car parking outside stadiums for commentators is never necessarily straightforward, but somehow Ellie, our production assistant at TalkSport, has got me into the broadcast compound right outside the Anfield Road end. So what a result that is.
Yeah, well, it's a good result, except when you want to get away, Dance, because you'll be at the very back of the traffic queue.
Luckily, having to do post-match interviews delay you a touch, because our game's going on TalkSport for the reasons Alex has mentioned. So, whereas normally I'll be on TalkSport 2 on a Saturday afternoon, I'll be doing the TalkSport commentary, but I won't have anybody else with me other than Perry and my producer, Izzy. So, I'll have to go down and speak to Graham Potter and Jurgen Klopp afterwards. Graham Potter, a boy of Solihull, as am I. I'm so proud to see him doing well. I'm just ashamed that Birmingham never snaffled him when we should have done a couple of years ago.
There was a funny incident, actually, just quickly before we go, with Graham Potter. We haven't touched on the behind-closed-doors commentaries that we were doing last season.
Oh, yeah.
Which was challenging, A, because you didn't have the natural energy of the crowd to feed off, but also at Brighton, the press box is right behind the home dugout. And the subs and the management team could literally hear every word that you were saying. And I remember Saeed Benrahma scoring a particularly spectacular late equaliser for West Ham. And I did go up a few decibels. And I remember Graham Potter after the game said to me, "I can't wait until the fans come back so that I don't have to listen to your commentary anymore."
I got soaked at Brighton last time for the game against Arsenal, because much as with Newcastle at St James's Park, it only takes a little bit of rain. And because, as with Newcastle at Brighton, the as you mentioned, the broadcast points are just behind the benches. Honestly, I got absolutely soaked. And there were towels, Tesco carrier bags that everybody was using to place over their equipment to prevent anything shorting out. That's proper scratch and sniff broadcasting, that was, I have to say. See, it's like being on the gantry at Southend, I imagine.
Correct. Honestly, and those, by the way, are the best experiences. At the time, you think they're not, but that's why we do it, Dance. That's why I love the early rounds of the FA Cup. It's proper. Anyone can do Liverpool, Man United. The audience knows all about them. Give us a story to tell.
You're right. I've just been given the chance to go to Stratford Town in the FA Cup first round.
Shrewsbury.
Yes.
Yeah, what a game.
Yeah.
What a game.
Stratford upon Avon, because of course, Stratford, East London, because no, it's Shakespeare country. So that's one to tick off the list. That'll be a lovely experience for me, I have to say. Gentlemen, what a delight it's been to have you both on the show. And I'm glad that you both got to know each other as well a little bit. That's always a nice little conduit and part of this. Peter, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Dan. So I've really enjoyed that.
I'll let you get back to your prep for Villa and West Ham. And Alex, I'll see you when I see you. We do bump into each other now and again, even though we're usually on opposite sides of the country.
Yeah, absolutely. Always a pleasure. And I've got to say, I found this a real education today, so hopefully the audience have as well.
Yeah, indeed so. Well, that's kind of what this show is about. But my thanks to Alex Crook and Peter Drury for joining me on this episode of The Commentator's Curse. I do have a very, very special guest booked for an upcoming edition of The Commentator's Curse. I can't say too much at the moment, but I've decided it will be a solo one-on-one interview, such is the magnitude of the guest that I've managed somehow to secure for this podcast. But more on that as we go. And another doubleheader interview next week on The Commentator's Curse. But my thanks once again to Peter Drury and Alex Crook. Thanks to you for listening. This is The Commentator's Curse.